Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Nothing but a man. Now, maybe a little girl in Shrewsbury uttered those words, and maybe she didn't. But historically, it seems clear at least that some people were thinking it some 230 years ago as they lined the streets, elbow to elbow, to see the nation's first president, George Washington, as he made his way across Massachusetts. The question was, as the new president journeyed across the original 13 states in an effort to unify them, would enough of those skeptics, having seen that nothing but a man, find him sufficiently larger than life to help hold our young country together? And that question is what makes our next guest's book so interesting. Nathaniel Philbrick, author and historian, has read and written a lot about the American Revolution, but his newest work, Travels with George, in Search of Washington and His Legacy, is a different look at the historical giant. And he joins us now to tell us about it. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So I did not think of George Washington. Excuse me just a sec. I didn't think of him in New England. I think of him in Delaware, right in the South. But he wanted to see all of 13 of what had been the colonies to unify them, didn't he? And so why bring that trip alive and why take the trip yourself as part of that journey?
Yeah, well, you know, we're living in times of what have been called repeatedly unprecedented political division. And I thought, well, what would it be like to follow George Washington's travels across the original 13 states when he was trying to unify this country? What if I followed him today in this time of division? Would I get what kind of historical perspective I would get by following the guy as he was trying to unify this country at the very beginning of our history? And so my wife and I and our dog Dora, doing our kind of John Steinbeck imitation, followed Washington and on several tours to New England, the Middle Atlantic, and the South as he was trying to create a sense of nationhood among 13 essentially independent states.
And following that same journey, what did you learn about where we are in our nationhood today?
In one sense, I found a lot hasn't changed. Washington, in trying to unify the nation, it didn't mean that Washington did not experience the kind of partisanship we know today. When he was elected president, two states, Rhode Island and North Carolina, had not yet ratified the Constitution. The Constitution had deeply divided the country into those who believed in the strong national government it created and those who distrusted that strong federal government and believed the states should retain the power they had under the original Articles of Confederation. So Washington heads out and to unify the country and actually succeeds in that. But even by the end of his first term as president, his own Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, is working to organize the political resistance. And that partisanship would expand to levels that even outdo where we are today by the end of Washington's second term. But even though Washington couldn't stop partisanship, even Washington, he had created something built to last. He had created a sense of nationhood that could survive those political differences of opinion.
So I'm going to do something we usually do a little later in a book conversation, which is have you read something. But I want to do it right now because I want to bring this home to Massachusetts. This was really striking to me. President Washington travels to Massachusetts. There's this argument about who should greet the president as he makes his way into Boston. And it leads, so you got Washington sitting on horseback in the middle of the street as dignitaries from Boston and the governor's office fight over who has jurisdiction to welcome the president of the United States into the city. Can you read that?
Yeah, sure. The newspaper editor, Benjamin Russell, who as a 13-year-old boy had watched the Battle of Bunker Hill from high ground nearby, was a member of one of the committees. Both authorities remained in their carriages while the aides and marshals were rapidly posting between them, Russell remembered. The president and his secretary had been mounted for a considerable time on the neck, waiting to enter the town. Washington asked what the matter was. When informed of the contretemps, he expressed impatience. Then he asked his secretary, William Jackson, is there no other avenue to the town? By that time, Washington had begun to turn his horse around and start back to Roxbury. This seems to have persuaded the contending parties to settle the dispute. Washington was informed that the controversy was over and that he would be received by the municipal authorities. The selectmen and Washington had won.
It's hilarious when you really think well, about it. It's hilarious.
Absolutely, and you know this. What he was encountering were turf wars, not only you know in the state, but between the state and the city. You know, once again, some things have never changed. And you know what made this different was the governor was John Hancock, who was you know the biggest dude in Massachusetts. Until, of course, George Washington shows up. And Hancock had invited Washington to stay at his home, his big mansion on Beacon Hill, where the State House now is. And Washington had said, no, I can't do that because I can't play favorites during this tour. I must stay only in public taverns. Hancock didn't like that and didn't show up to the ceremonies welcoming Washington to Boston. Washington then informs Hancock, well, I'm not coming to your dinner party tonight unless you come see me first. And Hancock realized he had made a gross miscalculation and comes and just pays tribute to George and making unmistakably clear that under this new form of government, a president outranks a governor, something that seems absurdly obvious today, but only because Washington did not accept John Hancock's dinner invitation.
So we're talking to Nathaniel Philbrick, historian and author of Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. And I want to stay on that. I'm glad you raised the Hancock dinner issue, because it was really striking to me that we were, in fact, sorting out for the first time, frankly, how important the president was going to be. And that John Hancock, who, you know, those who enjoy local history and certainly recognize the size of his signature, know that he fancied himself to be pretty important, too. And it was, in fact, his ego that set in relief and essentially wound up forcing us to establish in some important way this Federalist approach to the president, just at a time when, as you say, there were some pretty serious fights going on about how important the states were versus the federal government.
Yeah, and, you know, you might have thought, well, Massachusetts would have been thoroughly behind the president. And, you know, in theory, yes, but the practicality of having this new person show up who is dressed in his general's uniform, by the way, as he rode down what was already called Washington Street into Boston, you know, creates this phenomenon of people just going crazy as he comes into town. And, you know, this is creating that sense of the wow factor that, you know, we all see today in political rallies with music playing and jumbotrons and all that. Well, Washington kind of invented the concept with his theatrical entrance into towns and cities dressed as the revolutionary hero he had been. And yet, on the other side, he's trying to be one of the people, staying in public taverns. It's a tricky dance he's playing, and a tricky dance presidents still play. How do you lead a group of people claiming to be one of them yourselves?
So let's stay in Massachusetts a little bit longer, and then we'll step back and we'll pick up some of these bigger themes. You know, you know the area. You live in Nantucket. And in a minute, we'll talk about what you learned about the places he went that weren't around here. But I wonder, in traveling the portion of Washington's trip that was here in Massachusetts and here in New England, did you rediscover, did the sort of the scales of today fall from your eyes, and did you rediscover corners of history in our own region that weren't obvious to you until you were sort of looking at them through this lens? Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and it was happening every day we were following Washington. Well, you know, we were not taking highways. We were following those old historic roads that he would have used. And yes, they weren't the terrible dirt roads that they were in Washington's time. But what was really amazing to both my wife and I is, you know, we thought we knew Massachusetts pretty well. And this was particularly true north of Boston, as we're going from Boston through Marblehead to Salem and eventually into New Hampshire. You know, I knew those towns. I had visited them all. But usually I was driving the highway, taking an exit, and sort of parachuting into the town. we were following the old, you know, whether it was Route 1 or 1A, and inevitably that would become the town's main street. And so you began to feel that these towns were organically connected in a way that's not obvious today. If you're using, you know, the modes of transportation we tend to use today, whether it's a train or a highway. And so for me, this was a way to travel back in time. One of the frustrating things was, if you had Google on or something like that, it was always trying to get you on the highway. This was great. This is saying, no, you stay on those roads. They may be chock-a-block full of traffic, but you are following the original road that connected these towns and villages together as a cohesive unit.
And what's one place, one little building or corner here in New England that you either discovered or rediscovered when you were following in George Washington's footsteps that you can still kind of smell and see and connect with even now?
Well, you know, one of them, there's two. The one is the Old State House in Boston. I mean, you know, you see it, it looks like an old building, but going into it, knowing that George Washington had, they had built a temporary sort of welcome center for Washington on one end of the building where a parade with 50 different guilds marched past. And to think of the scale of the city then, And now you've got all these, you're in the cavern of tall buildings, but with the scale of that state house, which was then one of the biggest buildings in the city there, it was amazing. It just was like a time vortex. And then there was a time when we're in Newburyport. My brother used to live in Newburyport. I thought we knew Newburyport. Well, Washington stayed in a large brick building in Newburyport that is now the town's public library. And so I visited the public library, and you know, this is where Washington stayed, in the periodical section. it's just the sense of what has always been there has this untapped element of history that is there just for the looking. And so I thank George Washington to this day for reacquainting him with the state that I call home.
So I have to say, after reading that, I did find myself thinking, I will always look at the periodicals section of my library differently after that. So let's step back a little bit. Let's step outside of New England and talk about his journey across what was then, right, the country. Because it was really striking that he was looking at a nation in the dust and rubble of a revolutionary victory. It was a triumphant nation and a devastated landscape. And I want you to talk about that a little bit and what it was like to sort of superimpose that post-revolutionary rubble of that time over the incredibly developed, as you say, highways everywhere, you know, built up everywhere, entire species of pine trees, the long pine, that were indigenous to the area, just gone. What was that like?
Yeah, and then this was particularly striking in the South, where, as you mentioned, the longleaf pine. You know, these trees were everywhere in the South, from North Carolina down to Florida, all the way west to Texas. These forests of long, straight, trunked trees with their leaves up very high, and created this kind of magical terrain. And they're gone. I mean, most of us have never seen a longleaf pine. Now they're loblolly leaf pines, which are a very different kind of tree. And there are some new longleaf pine forests coming in North Carolina that we visited, and you get a sense of that. But then you get into Charleston and Savannah and inland and Camden, South Carolina. This is where in the final years of the Revolution, the war was fought, and there was devastation everywhere. And when Washington visited, he had been the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, but he had been trapped up in around New York on the Hudson River, and so he had been directing the war remotely when it came to the South. And this journey to the South, and the southern tour alone took him 3 months. He covered almost 2,000 miles, And he visited many of these old battlefields, and for him, as a former general, it was a truly amazing experience in which the overlays of time were, the devastation was still there in many instances. In fact, in Camden, North Carolina, the skeletons of the horses were still there from the Battle of Camden, fought in 1781. And so, he had a better understanding, I think, than anyone in the United States at this point, that America's freedom had come at a cost.
I'm thinking about all the different times that your choice to follow the same route Washington had led to metaphors. Right. And we've talked about a couple of those. Another that strikes me is you and your wife basically almost got sucked up into a tornado in your boat off the coast of Nantucket, which just the whirlwind of our political divide sort of seemed to be sucking your boat up into it, that metaphor. I wonder, of course, COVID happened, right, while you were trying to do this. And I wonder now, are there metaphors from what we're experiencing in this pandemic that tie back to what Washington was seeing then and how that has resonated with you as you finished your journey and wrote the book?
Yeah, I mean, it was really spooky where we do this tour of the country. It was a year and a half of following Washington. And, we didn't know what was coming. No one knew what was coming. And we finish up just under the wire, it turns out, and the pandemic hits. And then there is the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement and all this, the social justice movement happening as I'm working on this book. And these issues were latent in the journey as we followed Washington, where their Confederate statues were being removed, all of this kind of thing. But as I'm working on this book, the country is going through a pandemic where suddenly all the travel we had taken for granted is gone. We're all in our own little worlds, kind of fearful of others out there. I mean, it's kind of like a Stephen King novel. As I'm writing about a time that seems so distant in terms of Washington's journey and our journey, and yet all of the issues that were so latent within this journey are coming up and fresh, and the statues we had seen in Richmond on Monument Avenue were actually coming down. And so the writing process was, for me, something I've never experienced before, where, history connects with where we are now, and I got this tremendous sense of foreboding. Where is this headed? And so, I finished the book in September of 2020, just before the presidential election, and it was an experience like no other in terms of I've had in my career, where, I've never felt history feel on such a precipice of where we are now, and it just struck home that, what Washington was grappling with back then, whether it was the issue of slavery, whether it was the issue of how much power the federal government should have relative to the states, none of that's changed. It's just under a different guise. It's just an evolution as we race into this unknown future. And so this made our own journey seem like one that had an urgency that we didn't even realize as we were in the midst of it.
And you grappled with his slave ownership. You grappled with the decisions he didn't make cruelty.
And even before we headed out, I felt that this had to be a major focus of this book. It wasn't a major focus of his tour because he was trying to unite the country and knew that the issue of slavery would mean the immediate exit of the South if that should be pushed too far. And yet that meant, of course, that the issue was all the more important and all the more resonant with where the history would lead and where we are today. And so, Washington what impressed me by the end of this book was how far Washington had traveled, not just in around this country, but as a human being. I mean, this is a guy who became a slaveholder at age 11 when his father died, and he inherited some enslaved people. He grew up in this situation, and yet when he died, he freed his enslaved workers at Mount Vernon. That said, you can't let him off the hook. He may have been the only slaveholding founding father to do that, but it had waited till the end of his life. And in the final years of his life, he's actively pursuing Ona Judge, one of Martha's enslaved servants who had escaped to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Washington was trying to get her back. And so Washington was conflicted. He was paradoxical. He could recognize that slavery was bad for the future of the Union, but he had a hard time rising above it himself, which is, you know, kind of goes with humanity, in which, you know, we can aspire to be better, but very few of us actually are as good as we want to be.
And that is Nathaniel Philbrick, historian and author of the new book, Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. Thank you so much. What a treat to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.